Today's program is brought to you by Myriad Restaurant Group. For more information, visit myriadrestaurantgroup.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a destination. This week, I am happy to welcome Graham Holiday, a.k.a. Noodle Pie, and author of Eating Vietnam, Dispatches from the Blue Plastic Table, which was just released this week from EcoBooks and HarperCollins. So hi, Graham. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
You sound very, very far away.
I am. I'm in Senegal, but I'm just sitting at home. But a long way away, that's for sure.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm so excited to talk about your book. I was thinking about where I want to start this interview, you know, talking about your life and the book in Vietnam. So I think we're going to kind of thread the needle through this kind of semi-permeable membrane, kind of go in and out of both. Does that sound like a plan?
Okay.
So let's start with the book. It's a memoir of your life and your experiences in Vietnam. So maybe we can just start at the top by how did you, a British guy from Rugby, England, end up in Vietnam?
Oh, gosh, do you want the 7-inch version or the 12-inch?
The 7. Well, we don't want to give it all away. You know, they've got to read the book.
Basically, I graduated into a recession in England in the early 90s and no jobs, pretty miserable, middle of England, small town. Wanted to get out, desperately wanted to get out. So I figured a way to get out by retraining and moving. But I really wanted to move to Asia. I had a lot of friends who went to Asia, but they traveled and then they came back and they talked about Asia for a year or two and didn't really seem to do much else. So I didn't really want to end up like that. I wanted to go to Asia and live there and really experience it. And I just came across a photo of Hanoi, the road up to the Opera House near Hoan Kiem Lake. And it really kind of took me as just literally a faraway land, but I just thought I really feel like I want to go there and live there. And, you know, lo and behold, I did end up actually going and living there and ended up in Vietnam for 10 years. But it did take some planning originally with, finding employment that I could actually do in a place like that. But I did it, yeah.
And the subtitle to your book, Dispatches from a Blue Plastic Table, tell me a little bit about why this blue plastic table was so central to and Vietnamese food culture and how it became your post, essentially, when you got to Vietnam.
It's really because one of the things, it's difficult to remember back. You know, when you start to write a book, you start to recall everything and things start to come into sort of stark reality as they were, you know, all those years ago. And one of the things you first notice when you live in a place like Hanoi is the furniture, street furniture, where people eat. And a lot of these little tables, they are plastic for a start. They're often blue and sometimes red, sometimes other colors, but often blue or red. And, nearly every day of the week, after a while, once I got into life living there, I found myself sitting down at one of these cheap blue plastic tables. So when it came to thinking up a title for the book, I was actually at a loss of what to think, what to call it. And it was actually between myself and my editor and Anthony Bourdain that we kind of all together came up with this title. So it was a group effort, really, the title.
I think the blue plastic tables definitely kind of take you there. And I think they're made for smaller persons, if you will. I had quite a good few laughs of Westerners breaking the small plastic tables or the plastic stools when I was in Hanoi. Definitely maybe not made for the Western individual, per se.
No, if you've got a bad back, Vietnam's a tough place to eat on the street. That's true.
It was endlessly entertaining, I think, for myself and also for the vendors. But so you're spending all this time at these blue plastic tables, and eventually you get around to noodle pie. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about that journey and for anyone unfamiliar, what noodle pie is.
Okay. Well, when I lived in Hanoi for about 4 years, and among the friends I had at the time, there was a few of us who got interested in the street food and started eating around it. And I started a club up there where we'd go out once a week to kind of eat in some interesting place I'd discovered. And blogs didn't exist on the internet. You couldn't even access it back then, generally in public. And even if you could, if you were part of government, it was extremely slow, so it was useless. So I started to write a guide of places we used to go and eat, and I'd give it out to colleagues and what have you. Then years later, when we moved to Saigon in just after 2000 or so, blogs started to come about. I learned about them. They seemed very technical, very geeky for me, and I didn't really get it. And then very quickly, a company started up that made blogging very, very easy, and I got it very quickly. And it just reminded me of the fanzines, music fanzines I used to write as a teenager with friends back in Rugby about the independent music scene. And it seemed like exactly the same thing, you know, completely very, very simple to do, homemade, very punk, and it really appealed to me. So I started a blog, I think it was around 2004, 2003, something like that, and the blog was called Noodle Pie, yeah.
And pretty early on in the realm of food blogs, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that at the time, there were a few around. It was a very small community, mm-hmm. and there was one in particular called Fat Man Soul, which I really enjoyed, and he was like kind of the template. He was writing about food in Seoul, where I'd lived there previously. I'd lived in Korea, and it really hit the nail on the head. He's just, you know, just this guy going out for lunch every day and blogging what he ate. It was so simple, but it was brilliant. And then the other one, one of the other ones, was from your neck of the woods, which was Slice NY, the pizza blog run by Adam Cuban, who was a big influence as well. We've corresponded ever since those early days. We've never met, but yeah, we've always been. So those kind of early bloggers, as it were, a lot of us are kind of still in touch, mm-hmm. even though blogs are, you know, they're like antiques now.
Well, let's talk more about your experience. You go through a lot before you get to the good stuff, and you know, it's not easy going in the book. You're about 100 pages in, and you're still kind of pissed you haven't gotten to the good stuff yet. And I think this is one of my favorite things about the book. It doesn't really romanticize street food culture or the food travel experience. It doesn't glamorize like traveling to a developing Asian country. You know, there's plenty of blood and piss and all these things that I actually saw on my recent trip to Vietnam. But eventually you come up with the Ten Commandments of street food. So maybe you could, and you don't need to go through all of them, but maybe just share some of the most important kind of things to keep in mind when you are having this kind of food travel experience.
I think, you know, you just have to remember you're in a foreign country. And if you see people eating on the street or wherever it is in numbers, then, you know, they're not doing it to get sick or something like that. There's a lot of misconceptions that people have in the West that they're going to get sick eating this food, or they're going to end up eating dog or something that they really don't want to eat. But it's not true at all. Vietnamese people are extremely fastidious about their food. It has to be fresh. It has to be you know, good ingredients. It has to be cooked well. If none of those things are present and correct, people won't go there. They won't buy it. They'll walk away. Vietnamese people have too much of a respect for taste and for food to eat rubbish. So don't be scared of it. Just go and enjoy it, and maybe learn a few names of Vietnamese dishes possibly before you go. But I can understand, you know, if you're coming from the West, it's your first time in Asia, and you go on the streets in Vietnam, it can seem extremely intimidating because of the noise, the dirt, and the smells, which might be quite strange, and the food that looks very strange. But you know, the only way really to get in is to dive in and have a bash at it. The worst that could possibly happen is you might possibly get a little bit sick and spend a little bit extra time on the toilet. But after 10 years of living in Vietnam, the worst I ever got sick was in a French restaurant in Hanoi. And I never got sick from the street. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. It might happen to you, but in my experience, it didn't happen.
And mine as well. I ate nothing but street food all of my travels through Asia, and I never once got sick. So just kind of play down that fear factor, I suppose. So you also list, you go through the top 10 dishes in Hanoi, but you devote an entire chapter to bún cha. So maybe you can tell me a little bit more about what bún cha is and why it deserved its own chapter in the book.
Okay, well, bún cha is a very simple grilled pork noodle dish. It comes with two kinds of pork. There's kind of a stripped pork belly, very thin, which is grilled on a barbecue on the street pavement, along with these kind of pork balls, minced pork balls, which are served inside a bowl with fish sauce and finely chopped susu, which is a kind of a Vietnamese, I think they call it chiote in English, possibly some carrots. It comes with cold white rice vermicelli noodles and a plate of fresh herbs and lettuce. And you basically mix the whole up together however you like, and you eat it. Now, one of the reasons why I put it in the book is it's the first real kind of street food that I discovered on my own, and I discovered it really by the smell, because at midday, this is a dish that's only really served at midday from about 11 to 1 o'clock lunchtime, and it's a northern dish. Generally, you'll find it in Hanoi. It's more difficult to find in the south. It does exist, but it's more difficult to find. But you'll smell it before you see it, because there's all this grilling on the pavement of pork. And I don't know if you're like me, but you know the smell of pork over hot coal is pretty difficult to to turn down. So that was my first introduction to street food, was the smell of it first before I actually saw it, and then. And then I never stopped eating it when I lived up there. I think I tried over 25 or 30 different stalls when I lived there, yeah.
And component of bún cha that you mentioned were the herbs. And you also devoted an entire, well, I think maybe more than one chapter, in a sense, to the herbs of Vietnamese food. And you do say that they are the cornerstone. And you know, it's funny, I asked Mark Lowerson, who you also mentioned in the book, and I also asked Tracy Lister when I was recently there about what's the most important thing in Vietnamese food. And they said fish sauce. But I know that you dispel that and you go for the herbs. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about why you think that they are the most important component of Vietnamese cuisine.
Well, Tracy and Mark, I've never met Tracy, I've met Mark. They might be saying it because they live in Hanoi. Herbs are a little bit less ubiquitous in the north. You move down south to Saigon, and you know, herbs you get far more, far different, and always on the table, mountains of the things. So I think I would probably agree with Tracy and Mark when I lived in Hanoi. Fish sauce is ever-present pretty much in everything. However, when I moved south, I tried a lot more different dishes because the variety is so much more down south. And there's one dish called Ban Chang Phoi Suong, which is a dish which comes from the Chang Bang region of the south of Vietnam, which is about 30, 40 miles west of Saigon. And it's really, really simple dish because it's simply boiled pork, which is sliced quite thinly, served on a plate with some small pickled leeks, possibly some raw bean sprouts, and then this mountain of herbs, up to between seven and 12 different kinds of herbs. Some don't really even have names in Vietnamese. There's one, I think they just call it river herbs. There's no other word for it. And they don't grow. A lot of them don't even grow anywhere else in Vietnam. So now this dish has become popular. They ship the herbs up north to Hanoi now, so you can actually get it in the north. However, the dish is purely the meat and the herbs wrapped together in a rice paper, and you put it into the fish sauce. But the whole flavor is a combination of meat, fish sauce, the salt, and the herbs. But the flavor really comes from this mixture of all these strange, wonderful herbs. It wasn't actually me who kind of said that the flavor really comes from the herbs. It's a woman I met there who runs a restaurant that serves this dish, and she said it to me, and I suddenly thought, God, yeah, she's right. You know, Vietnamese food is nothing without the herbs. That is true.
Well, and for me, the biggest thing that stands out in Vietnamese food is the texture. I've never had food with such so many textures that really just added to the experience. And I know that's not a flavor component, but just nowhere else have I experienced such a wide variety. And it really made the food even more incredible. So since you touched on the North and the South, maybe before we go to a quick break, we can talk a little bit about the differences between the North and the South in terms of culture and food. Maybe you can use pho as example to kind of illustrate that. And but besides the fish sauce, we already got that covered. So,
well, the pho, which is a beef or chicken noodle soup, is probably the most popular dish within Vietnam and outside Vietnam. However, there's a very big difference between the North and the South. In the North, you get a very straightforward, simple, rich, tasty beef broth. Not a lot of else going on. Bit of star anise, bit of ginger. Beyond that, that's your soup with your noodle. And you can add fish sauce and vinegar and chili and half limes as you like. However, take the same dish down South, and it's completely revolutionized, really. So you've got a separate dish full of herbs, very high dish full of herbs, plus all the bean sprouts, which are often blanched before they're served to you. And then you sometimes, where you get that in the North as well, there's a fried breadstick you sometimes get as an accompaniment. But the broth itself is normally sweeter. And my taste, it's a bit more sophisticated and tastes like there's a lot more work gone into it. It's also sometimes a lot clearer, and it's often bigger as well. The bowl is actually bigger in the South than in the North. However, I prefer the pho in the South. It's true. But if you ask me which one I could go to now and have, I'd go to the one in the North, purely because that's where I had it first. It's rougher. The places where you go to eat it are rougher. And it's got a bit more kind of soul. In the South, it's all too much like the West, I think.
How often do you get back to Vietnam?
I've only been back once since 2006. I went there in 2013 to finish some research for the book.
Uh-huh. All right. We are going to take a quick break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be learning more about Vietnamese cuisine and culture with Graham Holiday.
You are listening to Dream Crisis by Seapoint. This is Native on heritageradionetwork.org.
We're proud to count the Myriad Restaurant Group as a business member of the Heritage Radio Network. Created by renowned restaurateur Drew Nearport, Myriad consists of a diverse roster of restaurants, each one unique and memorable. Delicious food, excellent service, and genuine value are at the core of Myriad's storied history. Tribeca Grill, celebrating its 25th anniversary, helped define the Tribeca neighborhood and is the perennial winner of the Wine Spectator's Grand Award. Nobu New York has innovated new-style Japanese cuisine for over 20 years, now joined by Nobu Next Door and Nobu 57, cooking Nobu's revered signature dishes. Batard, serving modern European cuisine, was named the best new restaurant of 2014 by Pete Wells in the New York Times, and similar plaudits in New York Magazine and The New Yorker, as well as earning a Michelin star. Myriad also serves up great ballpark dining at the Acela Club at Citi Field and tasty burgers at the Daily Burger at Madison Square Garden. The common thread is to be a good citizen in the communities they serve through the support of numerous charitable organizations. For more information, visit MyriadRestaurantGroup.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, we are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you're listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I am talking to Graham Holiday, author of Eating Vietnam, Dispatches from a Blue Plastic Table. So, Graham, I wanted to talk a little bit more about something that you bring up in the book. I'm wondering if people cook in Vietnam because they love it or it's because they're a best economic option.
Oh, well, you're talking about people on the street,
yes.
Obviously, who are doing for a business. I think, yeah, it's probably the latter, really. It's not a pleasure. It's purely an economic thing. You know, this is what I can do. I can do it quite well. People will buy it. I earn enough to get by. Sometimes it might not even be enough to get by. So it's not something. I mean, I sat down with these chefs and talked to many of them the same question, they find it quite strange if you ask them questions about Vietnamese food and culture, and you know, how this is the street food is wonderful and it's an expression of Vietnamese history and all, God knows what else. They're not interested at all. They just want the money, and it's. You know, some of them don't even know where the food comes from. They just know it's Vietnamese food. So it's always been with them. It's part of them, but they're only interested in the bottom line. And, you know, you have to respect that.
In regard to the bottom line, and I don't really have a well-formulated question around this topic, but you mentioned that bún cha, for example, is usually sold between like 11 and 1 o'clock. And with most street vendors that I experienced in Vietnam and other places in Asia, you know, once they're sold out, they're done. And, you know, that could be at 3 p.m. That might just be for the morning kind of breakfast rush. But it's so interesting as a Westerner coming to a place being like, you could serve all day and you would still have customers. You could keep making more money. But they're like, no, we're done. We're sold out. You know, that doesn't take into account their prep time and getting ready for tomorrow's batch. But I just think it's really interesting that they, you know, they close up shop. Maybe they open again. Maybe they do like a little siesta of sorts and then open again for a dinner time service. But I don't know. Maybe you could just kind of share. It's a cultural thing to just say we're going to close up.
There's a bit of that. But the thing is with Vietnamese food, generally, I can't think of any dish that doesn't take a long time to prepare. So even if it's served quickly and it's eaten quickly, it could take several hours to prepare. So certainly if you're looking at any of the Vietnamese soups, you're looking at a few hours here to prepare. That's not only preparation time, you've got to buy your stuff. So often the people who I knew there, they would get up at 3 or 4 maybe in the morning to start preparing their soup, start cooking their soup. Once their soup is sold, one woman I used to go to a lot, she would start selling at maybe 6 in the morning, and she might be sold out by 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. Once she's cleaned up and had a rest, she's got to go to the market to buy everything for the next day. Then she's got to get home and have lunch herself. Then she's going to maybe have a siesta. Then she's going to start preparing for the next day because everything needs to be chopped. Maybe some of the meat needs to be cooked, pre-cooked, and possibly the stock might need to be started as well. So all of those things do take a lot of time. So even though the actual serving time on the street sometimes is maybe just 3 or 4 hours possibly, you're looking at a full day's work nearly to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Helps clarify that a little bit. So I just got back from Northern Vietnam, and your book to me seemed very... very relatable, very relevant. But I think for someone who moved there in 1997, you probably see all kinds of differences from your time. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how things have changed for maybe the better or the worse.
It was fascinating to go back because, as you said, I moved there in 1997. I left in 2006, but I went back in 2013. So the changes were quite dramatic on a visual level, because in downtown Saigon, for example, the main drag in the center of Saigon, Le Loi Street, pretty much all the street food's all gone. It's all been cleared out. And in Hanoi as well, there's certain streets which street food's been banned. So from both the two major cities, a lot of that life that used to be on the streets and that tourists love, and the Vietnamese authorities want more and more tourists to come in, but, you know, it's slightly bizarrely, they're kind of getting rid of the bit that attracts the tourists in the first place. So the life on the street had changed in the centres. However, once you get out of the centre of the cities, down the little alleyways, all of that was pretty much the same. However, my local market, I went back there because I went, you know, I go to the market nearly every day, and it was really busy, especially on a Saturday. And I went down there every day for 2 weeks when I went back, and it was pretty dead. Some of the sellers I knew were still there, and I write about them in the book. But I went down purposely one Saturday morning at about 7:30 or 8 to see if the life was still there. And it really, really gone down. There were like three or four suits where there used to be 20 down there, and it felt a bit sad, to be honest. The other thing which I really noticed was a lot of the old wet markets up in Hanoi, not a lot, well, quite a few, had gone and been replaced by high-rise kind of big blocks markets or department stores, which one in particular, which is right in the center of Hanoi, is a disaster. I mean, it used to be a really, really lively market there. It's completely gone now. They've got a market, but it's in the basement. It's in a kind of car parking sort of area. Nobody goes. The sellers there all look completely miserable. There's no life. There's no noise. I think I mentioned in the book, it's more like something you'd expect in Pyongyang, not in Hanoi. And it's really quite sad. But I think I seem to remember the authorities have recently cancelled plans to, or postponed plans to, build more of these new markets, because the ones they've already built have been such a disaster that they realized we're not quite doing this right. So I hope that they won't destroy all of the wet markets before it's too late.
That was what I understood as well when I was traveling there, that they had suspended that program of sorts. So
yeah.
Another question that I asked many times when I was traveling, and you also bring up in your book, is this kind of tension of opinions between, will things change and will they stay the same? And I'm going to read from your book now, and you are talking to one of your vendors in Hanoi, and she says, look, even if Hanoi gets richer and richer beyond our wildest dreams, even in 1,000 years, the food, the streets will never change, never. And then you talk to another vendor in Saigon later in the book, and she's looking out at the street culture, and she says, all of this will be gone someday. So I'm trying to, I hope that it will never change, and I hope that it will always be there forever. But what do you think as far as finding the balance between these two opinions?
I think I'm going to have to disagree with you, actually. I think it is going to change, and it is probably going to go. It really, to be honest, it really depends upon how the country develops economically, because Vietnamese people are generally quite well educated, especially in the cities, and there's a lot of money about. People who are graduating from college looking for a career, they're not really looking to start a street food store. And also the other thing you find there, I talked to quite a few sort of young 21, 23 students or recent graduates, and they knew relatively little about their food. They were surprised at how much I knew compared to themselves, which kind of shocked me. And also they didn't really, the ones I talked to, it's not really a fair representative sample, I guess, but didn't really know how to. So a lot of the people you see on the streets who are serving this food, cooking this food, they're of a generation that this was the norm, this is what you do. Whether or not the younger generation are going to take it over in the same kind of numbers, I'm not quite sure. And you've also got the pressure from government, as I mentioned earlier. They want the tourists, and the tourists repeatedly say they love the life on the street, they love the street food. But the government go ahead and ban it from certain areas in Hanoi, do the same in Saigon, and have every intention, I think, of spreading that out further. So, the one thing is with Vietnamese laws is they often take some time to take effect, or sometimes they never really take effect. People just ignore them or don't even know about them. However, I think it's undeniable that the pressure from them is that they want to tidy up the streets. They want to look like Singapore. They don't want to kind of look the beautiful, rough and ready that you obviously like a lot, and I do myself. So I'm not convinced that things will stay the same. Things change everywhere, so it's inevitable.
Yeah, they have to change.
It changes into, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, and are you aware of any like grassroots efforts? Does that kind of exist there to make sure that food culture is protected?
The efforts I've read about, I haven't researched it in depth or anything, but I've seen a couple of projects that have been suggested to kind of have street food areas, like a kind of ring-fenced street food zone, which to me, it's, you know, it's like a zoo, really. So it just, this stuff lives on the streets. That's where it's, because it's not just about the food. This is the thing with Vietnamese street food, and in particular Vietnam, not like Thailand or Laos. They're slightly different. Vietnamese street food, the food is just one part of it. The street is the rest. It's the life. It's the dog yapping down the road. It's the cockerel down the alleyway. It's the all the mess under your table and the banter of the customers and the seller and everybody else who's walking past and the motorbike who's driving through the store while you're sitting eating. All of that is what makes it so attractive to us. And I think Vietnamese people who've had it all their lives, maybe they wouldn't really realize it until it's gone, and then they might get slightly nostalgic for it. But of course, when it's gone, it's gone. You can't just recreate it in the kind of, some kind of fake way. It's as it is now, it's organic, it's alive. But if you ring fence it, it's kind of a zoo, I think.
Well, I could talk to you all day about this, but before we have to say goodbye, I know that you are working on a second book. How far along are you in that process? And maybe you could tell us about where it's about.
I am working on a second book. It's very early in the process. I've planned everything. I'm going back to Korea next week. It's going to be about Korean food, well, regional Korean food, because I think lots of people do like Korean food, do know a bit about it, but perhaps don't really understand that food in Korea is very, very regional. And so it's kind of like it's not a travelogue. I'm calling it a foodalogue around Korea. So I'm taking it around Korea through food. It'll be very different from this book, but I hope it will have the same kind of energy and the same kind of life about it, because that, I think, you know, if you can translate that energy of the food and the excitement of the food into words, then you know, people can get something from that and hopefully be inspired to go and enjoy it themselves. So I start work properly on that next week, actually start writing it next week, and it's for Anthony Bourdain's book imprint.
And just to clarify, you did live in Korea prior to living in Vietnam.
Yes, I did. I lived in Korea for a year, and I went back for a four-month period as well. So, yeah, I had a very good insight into life in Korea. I was very fortunate in that I worked with some people who took me out for some amazing food every single week. So I learned a lot, and that's what kind of inspired me and still does. So I'm really, really excited to get back there. I haven't been back since 1999.
Wow.
It's quite a treat to get back, yeah.
Well, we
can't
will.
Wait.
Yes, we will. I know it's a little bit down the road, but I will definitely anticipate that book. And maybe we can have you back on to talk about Korea next time.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Heritage Radio today, Graham. And that is
Thank
all for
you.
Yeah, and that is all for Native today. Next week, I'll be joined by Ralph Cattell, chef of Trestle on 10th and Rocket Pig, to talk about his homeland, Switzerland. Be sure to tune in live right here every Thursday morning at 11 a.m.
The theme song for Native is provided by Evan Hashi.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.